Martha, thank you so much for inviting me to come today. I'm Anne Aldridge. I work as one of the chaplains at Adam Brooks Hospital, and I'm going to introduce to you two chaplains for this next hour of our session. First of all, we are going to hear from Eunice Dudbala, who tells me he's now changed his title. So he's Head of Chaplaincy and Bereavement Services. He's also involved in an end-of-life group with the Department of Health. So,
thank you very much. Thank you, Martha, for inviting me today to speak about end-of-life issues and chaplaincy. I thought I'd begin with just introducing myself. I'm Eunice Dudbala. I am Head of Chaplaincy at Newham University Hospital. And I've been working in chaplaincy for the past 12 years. I know I don't look it. Thank you. And I've been managing the chaplaincy for the last 7 years. I think the first question that might come to mind, looking at the audience, is what is a chaplain? So there's different definitions that you'll find around what is a chaplain. One of the definitions which I'll give here today is a chaplain is a professional who offers spiritual, pastoral, religious care and advice in a specific institution, institutional context such as an academic institution or a hospital institution, or a prison institution or a military institution. And from a Muslim chaplaincy perspective, I think the question then arises that if that person, the chaplain, offers spiritual, religious, pastoral support and care and is a professional in that institution, what qualification do they have to offer that care and offer that advice or provide that care or provide that advice? Does a Muslim chaplain have to be a qualified imam? And I think I usually, when I do some training with prospective chaplains, one of the questions I do ask is, does a chaplain have to be an imam? And I think sometimes a very good imam will make a very bad chaplain. And sometimes a non-imam will make a very good chaplain. So I think the answer is, it's not necessary for a chaplain to be a qualified imam, but they will have to have, obviously, some knowledge of the faith and practice of the faith, which gives them a level of understanding according to the institution that they're working in. So, for example, within prison chaplaincy, the questions would be different, so they need some expertise in that particular area before they become a qualified chaplain. In terms of the training that's provided currently for Muslim chaplains, there are certain Muslim chaplaincy courses, one which is being done by the Markfield Institute in Leicester, and one which is done by the Muslim Council of Britain under the Muslim Spiritual Care Provision, which is run with the Department of Health. And as a chaplain, I think you have dual accountabilities. You have the accountability from your faith community, and therefore you have to be authorized from your faith community that you are eligible to become a Muslim representative within an institution. But then the whole question arises that who's the bishop within Muslims? So, you know, I usually, whenever I do the training, I say, I'm the bishop. But, you know, the question does arise, who is the bishop within the Muslim community to authorize somebody with a license to practice to become a chaplain within the hospital. Now, in the hospital, if the bishop doesn't grant the license to the Christian chaplain, then they won't be able to perform their duties. But within Islam, we still have a myriad of different organizations who will be authorizing chaplains, but the MCB does a good job in terms within their Muslim spiritual care provision. So once a person becomes a chaplain, what do chaplains do? Chaplains are there for people. Chaplains bring a unique perspective because they talk to people every single day. And I think that is where the skill of a chaplain becomes unique in terms of their listening skills, in terms of their empathy, in terms of their compassion, in terms of them being non-judgmental. So I think chaplains are there for people. They're there for all faith and no faith. It's not as if we're there to preach people. We're not there to proselytize. We're not there to tell people what they have to do. We're there to support people in their decisions, to guide them in their questions, to answer their queries. And we're not there to give them what I think or what I want. It's what they want, and sometimes they need some guidance. And in terms of end of life, trying to think of end of life situations and what Muslim chaplains bring, I think we support patients, we support families, we support carers, and we support staff. So there's different aspects and different people that you engage with at the end of life. And when it comes to patients, you've got a patient who has an expected death, and you've got a patient who dies suddenly. So you've got two types of death. And in an expected death scenario, where a patient has been given some kind of diagnosis, where limited life condition, and the chaplain arrives by the bedside, what am I there for? And I think thinking of the scenarios that I've been involved in, it's about mental preparation. It's inevitable, you know, and from an Islamic perspective, death is an inevitable part of life. Everyone knows. And death is not a taboo subject. It's something which we're supposed to discuss openly. And therefore, it's about mental preparation for the transition of life from this life to the next life. It's about spiritual preparation. Sometimes they want spiritual guidance of, you know, I've done wrong in my life. What can I do to atone for those sins that I've committed? You will have scenarios where Muslim chaplains will be put in a situation where they might not agree with what's happening, but they're not there to judge, and they're not there to impose their particular views. And, for example, there have been incidents where the mother has been diagnosed with cancer, and she doesn't speak English very well, and the family is refusing to tell the mother that she's going to die. And then there's a dilemma of the clinicians are saying that we need to tell the mother of her condition. The sons are saying, no, that will give her a heart attack. And then the chaplain is called, you deal with it. So when the phone call comes and I ask, you know, what's the problem, and they tell me this, I say, I'm busy. But I think, you know, I think we, in Islam, there is autonomy. In Islam, there is, people are, you know, you shouldn't leave people not knowing. Because sometimes, especially within Islam, it's better if somebody prepares for their death rather than doesn't prepare for their death. If they can do much more in terms of asking for forgiveness, in terms of preparing the rest of the family of what they need to do. And this is where the chaplain, because of the confidence the family has within the religious school, that this is an imam, I trust him. Also, there was one gentleman who was alcoholic. He was a Muslim, alcoholic, and he had liver failure and he was dying. Now, again, I think this is the value of chaplains being within the hospital, learning about the systems, being there, interacting with people, because I can go there and I can be non-judgmental. And I can start looking at what support I can give to him and what support I can give to the family. Whereas I think if an imam was called from the community, they said, you're going to hell. Then you've got unexpected, sudden death. So how can a chaplain be a support for a patient then? And I think it's trying to make sure that we are protecting the dignity of the patient first. Because you can't do much for the patient, the patient's gone. But you can at least protect the dignity of the patient, make sure there's gender equality when nurses are looking after the patient, if it's possible, making sure the last offices are done properly within the Islamic tradition. And then you have the families and carers. And within expected death and unexpected death, the approach is different. Unexpected death, you know, the family has to come to terms with their loved one dying. And this is sometimes very, very difficult. And you have different expressions of grief. You have different expressions of reaction of how they feel that the person is going. And therefore, you prepare different individuals in different ways. But again, you use your religious knowledge, your religious text, to try and support them as much as possible. And, you know, death and dying is talked about during those conversations. We don't hide away from telling them that a person is dying within the next couple of days. It might be a week, it might be more, but somebody is going to die in your family and you need to be prepared for that. And how did Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, how was he prepared when somebody died in his family? And we give them anecdotes and stories to give them comfort of what is going to happen. Also, the families then start asking questions. When it's an expected death, they start asking questions, and they're not. It's different in different cultures, but they're not scared of asking about what do we do after death. They ask, what do we do about the funeral? You know, if they're dying. So although the person's still alive, sometimes people will think it's rude to speak about the funeral when somebody's still alive. But within the Muslim faith, because it's so important to get the death rituals done very quickly in terms of the burial, etc., then they will ask the chaplain to say, what do we do after the death? What is the process? What is the paperwork? How do we get it done quickly? So, and there's no, you know, there's no taboo in speaking about the funeral even before the death. In terms of the death certification process, end-of-life decisions, ITU decisions, there's a lot of times when we are asked to be involved. There was an organ donation case where there was a 24-year-old gentleman. He had meningitis of the brain. He was brainstem dead, and the organ donation team found out that the next of kin is in Pakistan. The death certification process, the medical certificate for cause of death, is the most important document to get the body released. Now, if we don't know the cause of death, it'll go to a postmortem. And if we don't, you know, how quickly do hospitals provide, or do the GPs provide the medical certificate for cause of death? That is a big issue around different hospitals. So the chaplain needs to educate the staff within the bereavement office or within the general office of how quickly and how important that document is for the Jewish community, for the Muslim community. Similarly, postmortems, if they are going to happen, are there any alternatives? The non-invasive postmortem is now an alternative for many Muslims and Jews around the country, where the postmortem is done with an MRI scan rather than with the invasive method.
I'd now like to introduce you to Rabbi Amanda Golby, who's been chaplain and rabbi up in Southport. Well, anyway, welcome to you, Amanda. We look forward to hearing what you've got to say. Last but not least.
Okay. Thank you, and like all the speakers, I feel very privileged to have been a participant today. I was somewhat anxious about presenting the final paper, aware that there might be some duplication, but very much hoping that this will just show, and I think this has been proven right, that our topics are all discrete, but also complementary. During my years as full-time rabbi in Southport and Nottingham, I combined my congregational work with serving as a Jewish chaplain, so it's slightly different to your experience of being there all the time. Special days of the Jewish year, festivals primarily, can bring strength and comfort and a measure of healing to those who are ill, particularly perhaps to those facing terminal illness, their families, their carers, and the professionals looking after them. And this is a bit of an aside, but for example, there is a Hasidic, and we heard something about that this morning, teaching that, well, I'm sure the person who wrote it was thinking only of men, but in my world of equality, it can apply to men and women and refers to that busy season which falls each year in the September-October time of the whole cycle of Jewish festivals and says how on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, we worship God with our minds because it's the day for remembrance and memorial. On Yom Kippur, when we fast with our hearts because fasting strains the heart. On Sukkot, the autumn harvest festival, when we shake palm branch with our hands. And now this reading says on Simchat Torah, the final festival of the cycle, with our feet as we prepare to dance. the word healing is important because I feel very strongly that it's different to cure. But again, that's outside of our brief and available time. My career in hospital chaplaincy began after a limited amount of training, I fear, and far more learnt on the job, with my first rabbinic post in Southport in 1988. In those days, it was the practice to go from ward to ward, looking at the handwritten record cards and seeing who had stated on admission that they were Jewish. I should say that at that time, as the first woman to hold a congregational rabbinic post north of Watford, until I was known, ward clerks or others whom I approached sometimes seemed ready to phone the duty psychiatrist. There seems very little difference between saying I'm Rabbi Golby and I'm Napoleon Bonaparte. In time, these records changed to receiving a computerised printout when just at the entrance to the hospital, and then a different problem area because of data protection legislation. As a full-time congregational rabbi, some of the patients were already my congregants whom I knew. Others perhaps belonged to another synagogue or no synagogue at all. And as you've said, the end-of-life issues that one encounters are either as the result of a sudden death, when clearly one is dealing with a very shocked family, or after a short or long illness, when one gets to know the patient, and sometimes in a very short time, it's possible to build up a major rapport. We, of course, know that even when death does occur after a long illness, the family are also very shocked, but there has generally been time to think about some of the issues, except in those cases where there's a complete denial of the inevitable. The progressive, as opposed to the Orthodox Jewish world, does permit cremation. But usually it's not possible to have a cremation quite so quickly. There are new civil regulations, particularly post-shipment. And also, while in London, where, say, at Golders Green Crematorium, there are quite a lot of Jewish cremations, when I was working in Southport, Nottingham, effectively people had to take their time and queue with everybody else. Something like 60% of Jews in this country are affiliated to synagogues, and people pay membership fees, though hopefully nobody is excluded because they can't pay. And the membership fees include the costs of the funeral. And so that means that a funeral can actually be arranged very quickly. A certificate, a phone call to the synagogue, and you usually know the arrangements, which is of the greatest importance if things have to be done quickly. Sudden deaths have other problems. Leaving aside the more profound theological questions and chaplaincy issues, when a child or a young person dies, or the death seems in particularly tragic circumstances, there are also practical issues. Judaism, and I think Islam also, is presented with a problem when it's a stillborn child. Many of our laws relating to burial and mourning are very long-standing, and traditionally there were no mourning rites for a child of under 30 days. This seems very harsh in our time, when however presumptuous and however much each birth is still a miracle, there's somehow the feeling that it will be all right. But it relates from the time when live births and children surviving the first month was far less common, and it was paradoxically designed to spare parents extra grief. Death by suicide causes clearly problems, not just at the time of death, but for a very long time to come. But it's normal practice to say that it was the result of mental illness or whatever, and not to have to bury, and to bury within the main part of the cemetery. And as we've heard repeatedly, a family can be very distressed if a post-mortem is required. Sometimes legal circumstances may make this necessary. Sometimes one finds people very frightened of the process of dying. Usually this means not so much fear of what happens afterwards, but how much pain they'll have to endure, how much dignity they'll lose. Judaism is life-affirming in the extreme, with the exception of idolatry, murder, and certain acts of sexual immorality. the observance of all laws may be put aside for what we term pikuach nefesh, the saving of life. Our customary toast before drinking is l'chaim, to life, and perhaps death is sometimes seen as a denial of this, with the consequences we've heard that Jews don't do palliative care or other such things, but it is a necessary part of life. Over recent months, we've heard much about assisted dying, which is a highly emotive issue, and clearly at one level not accepted by Judaism. But there are traditions of going back to the sources about, while not actively ending life, certainly not doing things artificially to postpone it. People sometimes want to discuss the meaning of life. Sometimes this involves very profound issues, sometimes more practical questions. Perhaps, again, as we've heard, a person feels the burden of something they feel they've done wrong. Sometimes we can help them to make peace in some way. Sometimes it's by actually effecting a reconciliation, or at least imagining what they would have liked to have said. Another difficult question is where we die. Presuming that there's a choice. I've often cautioned people against promising a loved one that they can die at home. It's not always possible, even with the best will in the world, and the family then are left with a deep sense of guilt that they've let their loved one down. There's enough guilt around at such a time without adding to it. The ideal is often to die at home, and perhaps a return to a time when death at home was commonplace, and perhaps the closer family structures of many Jews and Muslims can make this more possible. Certainly the government is being supportive of it, and one can say cynically that it's because it's cheaper. But much support is necessary, and it's not right for everyone. Chaplaincy work doesn't end with the death of the patient, and certainly not for someone who is not working primarily in a hospital setting, but within a congregational setting, and links with the family remain, often for many years to come. End of life can mean the end of the person's earthly life, but the legacy goes on for a long time. That there are formal rituals to do with the mourning in the house, the time when the tombstone is put up and the ceremonies, and all the difficult events, particularly of the first year, painful issues. And I don't know how much, but I like to think that we all make a difference in some way. Undoubtedly, we can all do more, but it's certainly very privileged work.